Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Everybody, this is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our wrap-up show of the 2017 Iditarod here on Mushing Radio. You can find all of our episodes over on iTunes if you haven't had a chance to catch up yet. You can also hear us on RadioFreePalmer.org and on their app, Radio Free Palmer, on the iTunes Store. You can also find us all over social media just searching for Dog Works Radio. Our co-host, Alex Stein, is on Twitter. His handle is at Coldfoot Films, and I am at Robert Forto, F-O-R-T-O is how you spell that. And calling in from California, just getting ready to live stream the banquet for the Iditarod on Iditarod Insider is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. It's we were talking last night when after the last musher had come in, and this has been both a very eventful Iditarod in certain ways, and in other ways it's been relatively calm. It's been relatively straightforward. We've had a couple of dog deaths, which is very unfortunate, but we were talking yesterday about how we haven't had like an overwhelming story that has dominated the Iditarod this year as it has in the past couple of years. So it's mostly been a calm and fast race, which a lot of people, I think, a lot of the competitors and a lot of the fans have appreciated.
I agree with you. You know, I know we didn't talk about this before we went on air, but do you have a favorite story from this year's Iditarod?
I have a couple of favorite stories, but There was a thing that Jeff King posted this morning. I don't know if you saw that, where every year in Nome they do a Meet the Mushers event, which is usually I think the Thursday or Friday after the winner comes in and before the banquet. And basically all of the mushers come around, and fans who are in from out of town and locals can go and talk to all of them and get their autographs and things like that. And there was a story about Jeff, the story that someone had posted where Jeff had, this fan had sort of a negative opinion about Jeff King and thought that Jeff was a little bit aloof because he had missed the signing thing a couple years ago when he had the snow machine, I guess it's last year when there was the snow machine attack and one of his dogs was killed, and the year before he had not been perhaps as friendly when they did the Meet the Musher thing. And they were talking about how the little kid of this woman who was writing in had wanted to get a dog booty and had gone out to the arch to try to get dog booties and hadn't been able to get a dog booty and went out there when Kristen Bacon came in and the child, I guess, has a rather soft voice and is not really, we're not as assertive as some people are, and so sort of wanted a booty but wasn't asking for it in a very loud voice, and so was being ignored. And Kristen came in, and there was a dog handler who was helping get all the booties off and put them in the sled, and then the dog handler heard that this kid wanted a booty and went over and gave him a booty and talked to him for a few minutes and then patted him on the head and then left. And the woman said that she didn't realize until they did the Meet the Mushers event earlier this week that dog handler was in fact Jeff King, who in the past may have for whatever reason been too distraught or had other things on his mind or may not have been as engaged and friendly with some of the fans as they might have liked, but he was out there just being a dog handler. Just helping Kristen Bacon get the team ready to go to the dog yard, and was there and just interacted with this with this kid, and the woman who posted this said that, you know, from now on, basically forever, Jeff King is her favorite musher.
Excellent. You know, my favorite story, I believe, is one that sort of hinged on the whole thing. It was just all of that information about moving from Willow to Fairbanks and all of the talk that went around it, you know, the faster trail. Is this going to be a permanent thing? Is this going to be a detriment to Iditarod? I just love talking about logistics, and I think that that was my favorite, just to see how all those pieces move into place when something like that happens. So on such a short time, another one of my favorites was some of the things that you mentioned on our daily coverage, like Ken Anderson's little boy running in on the runners, and also John Baker and Catherine Keith coming in together under the arch. I thought that was a really cool thing to do. And now we have a new story. Our buddy Hugh looks like he's going to get married tomorrow in the Nome National Forest, I think is what he said on Facebook. We talked about that yesterday, and he's going to be married by the mayor of Nome. That's pretty interesting in itself.
Yeah, and he had a big post about it on Facebook and said that they're going to be broadcasting this on Facebook Live. So anyone who is around Facebook at 5 p.m. Alaska time, which is 6 o'clock West Coast time and 9 p.m. in the East, should check out Hugh Neff's Facebook page for his wedding being live streamed. And then afterwards, there's a reception at the Breakers, which is one of the bars in town. Hugh Neff is a very very interesting and colorful guy, and it's an odd but wonderful thing. So we wish him the best.
We do, for sure, and I'm sure I'll get a chance to chat with him when he gets back into town, and looking forward to hearing what he has to say about his new life as a married man. I never expected that. He's been, sort of the world traveling musher all these years, and now he's going to have someone under his arm. So that looks to be very interesting. So let's jump over into today's topic. I know you wanted to talk about sort of how Nome gets everything ready to rock and roll during Iditarod, from that sleepy little village in the middle of nowhere to, a booming little town with upwards of a couple of thousand, maybe 3,000 people that arrive in and out during the week or two of Iditarod. What do you have for us about the little village of Nome?
Well, Nome is only a place that has a few thousand residents. I think it's about 4,000 or maybe 5,000 residents. There are, I believe, 3 hotels and maybe 1 or 2 bed and breakfasts. So there probably are less than 100 hotel rooms available, and yet thousands of people come in for the end of Iditarod. And there's a combination of ways that those people are accommodated. One is that a lot of the volunteers sleep in one of the churches, which opens up part of their facilities so that volunteers can sleep there. And the other thing is, a lot of people who just have, spare rooms or spare couches or something will register with the Convention and Visitors Bureau. And people who are coming in who weren't able to book far enough in advance or be lucky enough to be able to get a hotel room can call the Convention and Visitors Bureau, and they will give them, help hook them up with people in private homes who are renting out rooms or beds or couches. So it's sort of like a almost like Airbnb without the Airbnb, and the entire community just really comes together to figure out how to put everybody up. In addition to all of that, the mushers all have host families that they stay with, people who volunteer to have mushers, and in some cases the mushers families or spouses come and stay with them And a lot of times people have been running the race for a really long time will stay with the same families year after year after year. So there, it's very much a feeling that the entire community is coming together to help this race happen. Now, as you might remember, and people who have been to Nome might realize, in terms of the geography of Nome, it's a pretty small place. It's probably
right.
maybe 10 or 12 blocks by, I don't know, 5 or 6 blocks. And, you know, there's outlying areas, but that's the general area, of the downtown area. So it's relatively small. And when the Iditarod comes, they block off part of Front Street, which is the main street right before you get to the ocean. They put in a chute where they bring in snow and the Burled Arch, which normally is off to the side, not in the road, is put back in the road. There's fencing around it, and that goes for not all that long, but maybe 2 or 3 blocks. And then cars can go on either side around it, but they try to keep that area you know, free so that the mushers can come up, and then if they have to bring new snow in, they'll bring new snow in so that the chute will always have snow in it. And then when a lot of people arrive for the finish, for the winter coming in, a lot of, you know, officials from some of the sponsors will come in just for a day or two and then fly back out. A lot of fans and tourists will try to come in for when the winter's in and then leave. So it's every year when the winter comes in, there's usually several thousand people out on Front Street waiting for them. And in addition to that, there are people all the way down and some people on the ice before you come up to those 12 blocks or so coming into where the Burled Arch is. One thing that people may not realize is that whenever a musher is coming in, I think when they're about a mile and a half or 2 miles out, the fire siren sounds to alert everybody that a musher is coming in so that they can come and gather at the arch. And, you know, some years it's a little more sparsely populated, especially when you get towards the middle or the back of the pack, but there's always at least a few dozen people who come out, and sometimes, you know, depending on the time of day and who the musher is, there will be hundreds of people out, you know, to greet people who are coming in. And pretty much every musher who's come in is greeted by the race marshal, unless the race marshal for some reason isn't in Nome. So Mark Nordman will be out there welcoming everyone to Nome. Also, pretty much all the time, Stu Nelson, who is the chief veterinarian and, in my opinion, one of the real unsung heroes of Iditarod, he'll be out there, and he's a very interesting guy. You always see him. He's a very tall guy. He's always wearing this green parka with ruff on the collar, and you know, he is almost always very much in the background, doesn't say a lot, but will always be there. And when each team comes in, he sort of goes up and down the line, and he gives each dog a last minute once over just to make sure that there are no problems. And then the mushers will be checked in, which means that they'll have to sign the arrival sheet. The judges and the checker will make sure that they have all their mandatory equipment. They'll sometimes give a little speech or make a announcement or thank people or talk to whoever happens to be there at the arch. They, especially with the early racers, they're very strict about keeping people out of the arch except for, you know, approved media, which is the Iditarod Insider and the official media representatives and some family members. That gets a little bit more lax as more and more people come in. I think, frankly, just because there's less interest after the winners come in, and when someone is in 30th place, there is not as much pressure to keep people away because there aren't as many people there. And once they're checked in, they open up the other end of the chute, and the musher will get back on the back, sometimes with a friend or family member joining them, and they will mush down to the dog lot, which is maybe 50 or 100 yards away, right next to the mini convention center, and that's where they can take care of the dogs. There are volunteers there who work the dog lot, who make sure that the dogs get everything they need in terms of water and food and straw and things like this. So the mushers will come and they'll get their dogs situated, and then after 8 to 12 days on the trail, they are theoretically free to do whatever they want. A lot of them by this point are completely exhausted, so what they really want to do is sleep, maybe have a shower, eat. But because they've been on this very intense schedule where they are used to getting just a couple hours of sleep at a time, a lot of people who come into Nome, they think, oh, well, I'll sleep for 10 hours, and then they sleep for 3 hours, and they're wide awake because their body is sort of used to being on that schedule. So it takes a while to readjust to that. And then a lot of times, one of the things that I always am very, very happy to see is there are a lot of times where mushers will come out to greet other mushers who come in later. And it is, it's not necessarily just the mushers that they work with or know well, but they will often just come out to greet mushers as they're coming in to help celebrate the fact that they have completed this enormous task and this gigantic achievement of running a 1,000-mile race.
Interesting stuff for sure, Alex. A couple of parts that I could add. What struck me as very interesting when I went there for the first time last year was just how small the Burled Arch was. I always anticipated it to be much bigger than it was. It's not very tall, and it's not very wide, but when you're taking photographs of it or video, it always seems much bigger than it is. And also, Alex, I would imagine that a lot of the front runners' dogs have already been sent out or sent home. They try to get those dogs in and out as quickly as possible. I can imagine how much of a logistical nightmare it would be to get 1,000 dogs out, 16 dogs or less at a time, all trying to get to different places, most of them going to Anchorage and or Fairbanks. And then that frees up some spots at the dog yard. I did see this afternoon on Facebook that Martin Booser has his own little dog yard. I assume it's in a friend of his yard, not too far from the original or the main dog yard for Iditarod. He had little igloo houses for his dogs there in their yard, and you could see the other dog yard in the background. What's also interesting to me, Alex, is just the amenities of Nome. There's not a lot of places to eat and or drink in Nome for all of those people that are there. I only saw maybe one or two really small restaurants, a couple of coffee shops that serve sandwiches and soup, and there's several bars, but they, it has bar-type food, just finger foods with burgers and stuff like that. But in that little town, there's not a lot of places to visit, especially if you're there for a week or so, is there?
Right, and a lot of people, there's a lot of people find that they're kind of wandering around. They're waiting for things to happen. They're waiting for mushers to come in. There is a sort of golf tournament. There they set up golf holes on the ice near the Nome National Forest. And a lot of people do that. It's run out of the back of one of the bars, and it's really less about golf and about drinking, I think. Although every time
right.
I say that, people get upset with me. But you know, there's not, you're right. There's not a lot to do. I think there's a museum at one end of town, but you can just sort of wander around so much. And then you find yourself going to the same places over and over again. And as
right.
as you know, it's also very, very expensive because almost everything has to be flown in. So, you know, a gallon of milk is two or three times what it would cost you in Anchorage or Wasilla. And, you know, a can of soda is very expensive and food is very expensive. So it's a little bit of a difficult place to visit as a tourist, and I think that's why the people who are there right now are really just there for Iditarod.
Right, and as you said, you know, once everything is happening, you know, they're not coming in all at once. There may be several hours that separate, you know, the different mushers coming in, and sort of a musher schedule by design is to run at night, so they don't want to come in the middle of the afternoon. It's too hot to be running the dogs throughout the heat of the day, so they time themselves to come in either relatively late in the evening or relatively early in the morning. So for the visitor that is there, they may find themselves with quite a bit of time just sitting on their hands, so to speak. And one interesting thing is with just about all villages here in Alaska, you know, nowadays everybody is so internet, everything has to be on at all times. We have to be able to update Facebook and do everything on our phones. And that's almost non-existent as you walk around the streets of Nome, unless you're in the convention center or possibly in one of the bars or restaurants or potentially your hotel, you will not have high-speed internet. And if you do, it will be relatively slow compared to what you're used to in your hometown, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that only gets worse when there are hundreds or thousands of people trying to use the same Wi-Fi signal in the mini convention center or in one of the hotels. So it's, you know, for those of us who are used to being plugged in 24/7, it can be a little bit of a shock, and you really have to pay attention to the things that are around you rather than just existing online, which I would argue is probably not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing at all, and it's good to get away, and I had a great time when I was there. I was only there for a few days, and I've been to several villages here in the bush. I've been to Kotzebue and Barrow and, you know, Tolk and some other places along the way, and each of them have their own very unique amenities and little quirks, and I think that's what makes Alaska cool. You know, it's not like traveling through you know, the Midwest where, you know, at every exit, everything exactly the same. You know, there's a McDonald's on every corner and, you know, an IHOP and a Walmart and everything else. No matter where you're at in the country, you can be pretty sure that you're going to find the same thing at everywhere where you go. So I think that's what makes Alaska very unique. So as we know, the banquet happens on Sunday. It always is on Sunday, which is tonight. That's when they'll give out all the awards. And then after that, everybody packs up and goes home. I'm sure the flights out of Nome will be dang near standing room only, not only tomorrow, but probably Tuesday or Wednesday as well. Did you fly out after the banquet, Alex? And if so, how difficult was it to get home from Nome on that day?
I flew out the next morning. They also, I don't know how many flights there are usually from Nome, but I know that they add an extra flight on Sunday night, which they call the banquet flight, where they will have one extra flight going back to Anchorage. And what generally happens is that because the banquet usually is not quite running on time, and this year they seem to be about an hour behind schedule. They will announce at the banquet that the flight is about to leave, and anyone who is at the banquet who wants to be on the flight needs to leave and go to the airport. usually the president of Alaska Airlines is there, and inevitably someone will say, well, you know, they'll wait for this guy, but they're not going to wait for you.
So you're
going to make sure that you get there at least before he does. And then I flew out on Monday morning, and there were a lot of people there. The flight was completely full. I think there were a lot of people who were trying to get on standby, who were supposed to fly back later but wanted to fly back earlier. So there was a lot of kind of jockeying for position in the flight. But I had, for whatever reason, I had decided that I was only going to be there for a few days and knew that I had to get out on Monday morning. So it's so odd because when you fly back from Nome to Anchorage, it takes, you know, a little over an hour. And to think that you can cross that distance in an hour that takes people 2 weeks on the back of a sled is kind of amazing.
It is amazing. And you know what's interesting, Alex, for folks that haven't had a chance to visit remote Alaska, just how small the airports are. You know, here is Alaska Airlines, one of the largest, mid-cost carriers in the country, and their little terminal is not much bigger than our living room and our office where I'm sitting right now. It's very small. It reminds me of a small-town bus station. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm sure that it is a little bit different during Iditarod time, but the people who worked for Alaska Airlines who were there in Nome, and the people just in general at the airport in Nome, were just unbelievably friendly and really going out of their way to accommodate everyone. And I think it's because, you know, there's this shared purpose of everyone being brought together by Iditarod. I think that's something that is really tangible, especially when there were all these different people going to different places trying to coordinate their travel and trying to be able to get home and get out. So that was kind of an amazing thing to see.
You know, what's also interesting about the airport, one last point, then we'll jump into the awards. What I thought was pretty comical is you do the whole take your shoes off, go through security type thing, and then within just a couple of feet, you're outside with your shoes in your hand and your belt in your pocket and out on the tarmac and expected to go to the plane within just a couple of feet of going through the scanner.
Yeah. Yeah, and for some of the planes, they have what I'm not sure what the exact term for it is, but basically a split plane where they have the middle half of what would be the middle seats is a cargo area. So especially in Iditarod, when they're getting a lot of sleds and dogs in boxes and things like that, they have planes like that, and so if you're in the front of the plane, if you're in the first half, 10 rows or whatever, you go in through the front of the plane. Otherwise, you go in through the back of the plane because you can't walk in the middle because that's cargo.
Right. All right, Alex, we are just about out of time. I'm sure we will go over. We still have two things we want to cover. Let's run down quickly the awards that we know at this point. I know that there are several that will be announced at the banquet, including the Sportsmanship Award and the Golden Clipboard and those sorts of things. But can you run down mainly the awards on the trail, like the the first to Yukon, et cetera, et cetera. And then we want to make sure that we talk about our last featured musher of 2017, Iditarod, Anna Barrington. Is that right?
Yes, and I've also been, as we've been on the air, I've been keeping track of some of the other awards as they're being tweeted out and as they're being awarded. So just running through these, the first to the UConn Award, which this year was the first person to get into Tanana, was Nick Pettit, who won $3,500 plus the multi-course meal prepared by the chefs from the lakefront. And then there was the Pen Air Spirit of Alaska Award, which usually is the first to McGrath, but this year it was the first to Ruby. And it's often been a spirit mask, a native spirit mask, but this year it was a beautiful painting by John Van Ziel, and a $500 flight credit, and that went to Wade Mars. The GCI Dorothy Page Halfway Award, which this year was the first musher into Hooslia, went to Mitch Seavey, and that, I believe, is Gold Nuggets. Mitch also won the Bristol Bay Native Corporation Fish First Award, which is the first into Caltag. And Wade Mars won the Wells Fargo Gold Coast Award, the first musher to the coast to Unalakleet. So Wade Mars won that. The Nome Kennel Club Fastest Time from Safety to Nome went to Nick Pettit. The Jerry Austin Memorial Rookie of the Year Award went to Sebastian Verneau. And Ryan Reddington got Most Improved Musher. And then Alan Moore got the Sportsmanship Award, the Donlin Gold Sportsmanship Award, which is voted by mushers. Jesse Royer won Most Inspirational Musher, which also is voted by mushers, and the prize for that is free entry, your free entry fee for next year's Iditarod. So that's that's very exciting. She came in fifth place with all 16 dogs, and just was was somebody that everyone was very, very happy for, and someone who just seemed to always be smiling and always have an amazing attitude. And every year there are a couple people or one or two people who will finish with all 16 dogs, but I don't remember anyone ever finishing that high up in the rankings with 16 dogs.
Right. Is that all of them so far that we know?
That is all so far. Yeah, and there's a couple of more. There's the Herbie Nyack Award, the Golden Clipboard Award, which goes to the to a checkpoint, and the Leonard Seppala Award, which is for outstanding dog care, which is voted by the vets.
Excellent. Yeah, and those will be definitely on Twitter. You can follow there with Alex. I'm sure he'll be up tweeting those as they come in. At Coldfoot Films is Alex on Twitter. Okay, let's jump over to our last musher profile of the evening and of the season here. We're going to talk about one of the Barrington twins. We've talked about her sister, Christy, several times, but we have not talked about Anna, have we?
No, And it's, you know, it's kind of appropriate that we talked about Christy first, and that Christy ran the Iditarod first, because Christy is 5 minutes older. So they are twins. This is Anna's sixth Iditarod. Christy has run eight. They were both born in Port Wing, Wisconsin, which is on the southern shore of Lake Superior. Their parents did not realize that they were having twins until they were born, because of their synchronized heartbeats. They just thought it was one baby. They grew up on a family farm. They had lots of animals when they were growing up, and they were relatively near to where the John Bear Grease is run. So they were exposed to the idea of mushing and dog racing at a young age. They famously decided when they were kids that they were going to make their own makeshift sled using skis and a milk crate, and then they had their border collie and a Great Pyrenees pull this pseudo sled, which was very confusing to the dogs. When they were in junior high, I believe they started helping out on weekends with a neighbor who had a kennel and ran sprint dogs. By the time they were both in high school, they were 6 feet tall and have always been athletic and competitive, competed in track and field, cross country, volleyball, baseball. After high school, they both joined the Army National Guard, and they saw an ad in a magazine for dog handlers in Alaska, and they thought that that sounded like an interesting thing to do, but they didn't move to Alaska yet. They first moved to near Lake Tahoe in the Sierra Nevadas in California and started giving tours, working with a company that did horseback tours and sled dog tours. Christy went up to Alaska in, I believe, the summer of 2007 and happened to meet Dean Osmar, who convinced her that she should move to Alaska if she was really serious about wanting to run dogs. So they both moved up to Alaska later that year, worked some with Dean Osmar, learned all about distance racing. Christy started entering races. Anna started entering some races as well. And Christy started training with Paul Gebhardt. And Anna stayed behind and was working with Dean Osmar. In 2013, Anna moved to Knick near the Iditarod headquarters and Joe Reddington's old homestead so that she could work for Scott Jansen and train with Scott. Like a lot of Alaskans and like a lot of mushers, they both work various seasonal jobs, including construction and commercial fishing. A couple years ago, they started a kennel together called Seeing Double Kennels, and it's kind of a family affair. Christy's fiance helps them train the dogs. Their older sister, who's 5 years older than them, runs their website and is there every year at the start and finish of Iditarod. When they've been running together, they have alternated. They have generally finished very, very close together, like within a couple of minutes and in some cases within a few seconds. And they've alternated who gets to come in one position ahead of the other one. The only year that they didn't finish together was 2014, and that was when Christy came in 30th and Anna was way back in 39th. And they said at the beginning of this race that they weren't necessarily going to run together, but then they mostly did. They seemed to just have not only an incredible enjoyment of mushing and of being outdoors and in the great wilderness in Alaska, but a real strong sense of camaraderie and a little bit of competition and genuine enjoyment about being in each other's company. And that seems to be why they have mostly been running together. 8 years ago, Anna got fairly bad frostbite in a race, and she had to have the tips of both of her big toes trimmed off. In the off season, they both compete in marathons and half marathons, and they are building up their team from dog bloodlines from Dean Osmar, Paul Gebhardt, the Reddingtons, and Mats Peterson dogs. And they have said that they are always looking for ways to reuse and recycle equipment and stuff so that if they find 50-gallon plastic barrels that people are throwing out, they repurpose them into dog houses. They collect booties and send them home to be washed and then sorted and reuse the ones that can be reused. and they visit local restaurants and ask for empty cans that they can repurpose as dog dishes. Anna said about the bond between mushers and dogs. She said, our dogs trust us, and they trust that we're not going to ask them to do something that they're not capable of. And when they think something is hard, they keep going because they trust that we're not going to ask them to do something that's beyond their capability. So the dogs are able to give them a little bit extra beyond what is comfortable, knowing that they know when it gets dangerous and will pull back and not let the dogs do anything that's dangerous or harmful. She said that the one piece of great advice that they took from Lance Mackey is that you should strive to put yourself in situations that are uncomfortable but not dangerous. And it's important to be able to learn the difference between the two. So you should push yourself to do a little bit more than maybe you thought you could, but you should also know what your limits are and not push yourself too far so that you get yourself or your dogs into a situation that is going to be harmful. And she said that... And this is a sentiment that I've heard almost every musher who's not, you know, someone who is year after year competing to win say. She said she'd like to win, but she says winning is not what defines success for her as a musher. And as long as you can keep improving and keep learning, it's good to keep going. And she, both Anna and Christy have never scratched in an Iditarod. In 14 Iditarods between the two of them. And they are charming, and it's hard to look at them and not root for them. And it seems like they are certainly mushers who are going to be around for a very long time in this sport.
I did not know that they had joined the National Guard. That just shows a little bit more toughness to these ladies, and they are definitely tough ladies for sure. I believe we did have Christy on the show a couple of years ago as an interview in the off season, and she had told me about the whole thing. You know, one thing to add to that, Alex, when you're mushing together like that, you know, a lot of our training that we do, and even on the expedition that we went on this past week, one team is always chasing the team in front of them, so they always seem to be wanting to go much faster than the team in front, and that team that's behind is always riding the brake or riding the drag or keeping a distance between them. I can only imagine how difficult that would be to control traveling 1,000 miles together that way. I wonder how much space they give each other between the checkpoints, because often they'll come in pretty dang close to each other into the checkpoints as well, not just the finish there in Nome. And secondly, what I would like to add is you had mentioned that they had never scratched. That is a remarkable feat, considering that they're taking care of each other out there on the time. So they're not only mushing together, but I'm sure that they're doing other things together on the trail as well, whether it be, you know, taking care of the dogs or setting up camp at in between checkpoints and so on and so forth. But what a way to travel throughout the country is just being there, not only with your sister, but I am sure that they consider themselves best friends. That would just be a cool way to not only know that you're traveling together, but just that whole safety with that. If you know that you're going to have trouble in one way or the other, there's always somebody to get your back. And I think that's a cool thing, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, not only do they have the family bond of being sisters, but you know, they're twins. So literally they have shared the same womb, you know, before they were born, and have just have that kind of closeness and that kind of bond. It's sometimes people look at mushers like like Anna or Christy Barrington, and they think, oh well, they're very pretty, and therefore, you know, they're not serious. And it's an odd thing, because they are very pretty, and so there's a tendency for some people to want to discount any woman who is pretty. And all I can say to that is, yes, they are very pretty, but these are incredibly tough women, and they may play it off a little bit and may underplay how difficult some of the things that they do can be. But these are people who are running 1,000-mile races and are, you know, out there when it's 50 or 60 degrees below zero. So there is nothing that is, there is nothing that is pampered or that is fluffy or inconsequential about anyone who does that, no matter what they look like.
And they're very consistent middle-of-the-pack mushers. They have been most of their career. And that is, that's a very strong feat in of itself, to remain very consistent over all of those years. And, of course, a lot of that has to do with the dogs that you have. It depends on how often you're able to train and run your dogs in the off-season, where you live, what weather is available. You said that they lived in Kinnick, which is just right down the road from us. And the last few years, our snow has been absolutely terrible. It was good this year, but training really took some getting to. We had to drive hundreds of miles to find snow. So all of that comes into play about where you finish. You know, very few mushers, as we mentioned on this show earlier this year, very few mushers can do this for a living. And those folks have the ability to spend the resources to do what they have to do to get it done. But I would say, I don't know what, maybe 90% of those guys just don't have those resources to be able to do this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They have other commitments as well. All right, Alex, we are definitely over time, and I want to make sure that we end our coverage this year to thank all of our fans and our listeners. It's on Facebook and Twitter this year about people enjoying our coverage. It's always humbling to hear people say that they've been listening to us for years and we are their go-to source every night where they get their support for the race. You know, they're getting their stories and things from us. That's an awesome thing, and I can't say thanks to those enough. So thanks to all of our friends out there. Is there anybody you would like to thank specifically? And after that, we will talk about our next show in the off season, and we'll close.
Yeah, I have a couple of things I just want to mention, and people I just want to mention really briefly. There is a new website that is out there called SledDogInfo.com, which was put together by a bunch of people who have been in and around the world of mushing for many years as an effort to put out some real information about mushing and about how the dogs are treated to counter some of the anti-mushing stuff that is out there. And some of the people involved with that are Helen Hegener, Shannon Miller, Scott Chesney, Jan DiNapoli Cosmuto, Lauren Dick, June Price, Albert Marquez, Tony Reiter. And that's a really great resource that just launched relatively recently, and it's building more and more stuff into it. So I would very much urge people to check that out. It's sleddoginfo.com. There are two things that I don't know if they're new, but they were new to me this year that were very enjoyable to listen to. K-Nome had a daily podcast for much of the race called I Did a Pod, and you can find that at K-Nome's website. And there also was a podcast put together by fourth graders called I Kid a Pod, which was generally like 8 to 10 minutes, and it was all fourth grade kids talking about the Iditarod, and that was that was really, really fun to listen to. And you can find that, I think, at iTunes. I was very amused. This Iditarod, there was a parody Twitter account called at Iditatrump, which was Donald Trump type tweets about the Iditarod. So check that out. It's some very funny stuff. I just wanted to acknowledge when I first started getting into Iditarod, one of the things that was most important and inspirational to me was June Price's book Backstage Iditarod, which is a wonderful book about the volunteers who make this race possible. And Don Boyers wrote this great book called Back of the Pack, an Iditarod Rookie Musher's Pilgrimage to Nome. Unfortunately, he's since passed away, but he was a member of the Iditarod Air Force who then decided he wanted to take up mushing and ran Iditarod. And in fact, if you look at Iditarod.com, his trail notes for the trail and the country and the way that the trail goes between various checkpoints are still being used, and those are, I think, at this point, close to 20 years old, but they're really wonderful. I want to thank Michelle Forteau, who stepped in when you were out on the expedition and did a wonderful, amazing job, and it was a lot of fun to have her perspective on things. And then I want to thank you, because we've been doing this now for 5 years, and it is wonderful and amazing, and it has it's enabled me to meet a lot of amazing people and to learn a tremendous amount about the race and about mushing. So I wanted to thank you again for that.
Likewise, Alex, the show wouldn't be the same without you. We have been doing this for a long time together, and it's just amazing how fast it comes upon us every year. You know, we do that biweekly show every week, and March smacks us in the face every year just about how quickly it gets to us. And we'll keep plugging away as long as people continue to listen and continue to get feedback. I enjoy doing it, and it's not necessarily a labor of love. It's just something that we do, and I think both of us enjoy doing it. So, yeah, definitely thanks to you, Alex, as well, and definitely thanks to all of our fans and to all of the mushers and dogs out there that make this sport as awesome as it is, because it would not be the same if we didn't have anything to report about. So with that, let's end the show talking about our upcoming show this Wednesday. It'll be at 5 o'clock Alaska time, 6 o'clock California or West Coast time, and then that will be 9 o'clock on the East Coast. It will be right there on KVRF 89.7 here in the Valley. It will be a live show. As far as I know, I think we're still the only podcast on a terrestrial radio station anywhere in the world, which I think is an awesome accomplishment, Alex, and I have to pat both of ourselves on the back for being able to do that, and KVRF with the vision and the foresight for allowing us to air on their radio station. I think that's definitely a cool thing that we are able to do that. So we're going to be here next Wednesday, just in a few days, and we're going to talk about the expenses of running a kennel. And I'm going to talk a little bit about our expenses on a mid-distance kennel, and then we're going to talk about the longer distance kennels and some of the things that they have to do to prepare for races like the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest. So with that, Alex, it's been a pleasure this last couple of weeks. We'll talk to you in a couple of days, okay?
All right, great. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is our coverage of the 2017 Iditarod. If you don't listen to us till March, we will see you then. Have a good night. Goodbye.